afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. Today is James Corbett Day, so for the second and third segment today, you will hear a pre-recorded segment due to the time difference, as you know. James lives in Japan, so it makes it difficult to do live broadcasts with Jim at this time, 4 o'clock Eastern time. So we pre-record a program, and you will hear him for the second and third segment today. And James is so insightful, and he does some great work, and Bob Chapman chose well as a replacement. And Jim continues to be the lead writer for the International Forecaster. So let's go ahead and get started right away. And today is August 24th, 2018. So let's go to the gold prices today because we finally had a decent day in gold. Yay! Gold was up. It was up strong all day. $1,205.90 right now, up $20.30. We had a high of $1,209, so it was higher. It did pull back a little bit. Silver today was up 31 cents at $14.87. Platinum was up 13 at $793, with palladium up $23 at $945. And again, there was pressure on the dollar, down 0.48 at 95.13. And crude oil was up 0.79 at 68.62. But the stock markets also had a very strong day today. None of them were up 1%, but a half a percent for the Dow was up 133 points, 25,790. The NASDAQ was up 67 points at 7,945. The S&P was up 17 at 2,874. 10-year yield today, 2.83%. Euro was stronger, 1.16. Asian and European markets, you know, about the same kind of 0.25% increases on most. Hong Kong was down almost 0.5%. And the motion driving the market is a little bit stronger, 67 the day. So we're still in that greed territory, but it's not... you know, it's not skyrocketing. It's not the 80s and 90s. So there's a lot of caution yet still in these markets with them hitting this record for bull territory that we've, that the paper markets, I should say, experienced or made the record on Wednesday. But it certainly has been a week with the plethora of wacky news in our collective national psyche. I mean, we've had the Manafort case, we had the Cohen, we had the Weisselberg, he's been given immunity, we had Pecker, he's been given immunity. We learned that the U.S. has had special op forces in more than one African nation. And James Corbett does touch on what's going on in Africa. We've had the trade spat. I'm going to talk a little bit about that with China, how that is ratcheting up a little bit faster. And the Iran is making a deal with the EU in euros, just to avoid U.S. sanctions. And it hasn't been much different for gold either, up, down, all around. After starting the week, coming off a 20-month low, we have COMEX short positions. It's going to be updated today, as it usually is on Friday. But last week's data showed the hedge funds and money managers, they raised their net short positions for the sixth straight week to another record for the week of August 14th. So, you know, they're going to be doing a lot of covering. So, you know, we'll see how that affects the price of gold. Some more interesting news. We have Silver Eagles. They jumped off their lows in May from their lows in May of 380,000 to so far 1.2 million in August. So we'll have to see how the month closes out for the month. We'll see what we have a full week next week in August yet. Will we do 100,000 more or 200,000 more, 400,000 more? Don't know. We'll see what the silver prices do on Monday. That'll be a good indicator if the purchasing, the demand will continue through this last week of August. So it is a good sign. And people did take advantage of those of the lower prices in silver for this month. And with gold higher today, of course, that comes from as the dollar came under pressure today. There, you know, it's interesting because we had the Jackson Hole, Wyoming meeting. economic meeting. And, you know, there's usually some big heads of states and business leaders and so forth. And it was very little talked about, of course, since President Trump made president. You really don't hear much about anything else, you know, from media or anything. You have to kind of look for it. But it was interesting because everyone was sort of waiting for Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell to make his little speech today to see if they could get some sort of a clue about the direction of U.S. monetary policy. But Chairman Jerome Powell said today that he expects a slow but steady diet of interest rate increases. They're going to continue as the central bank looks to find the right recipe between promoting growth and controlling excesses, of course. In his closely watched speech at the Jackson Hole, Wyoming Fed's annual retreat, he expressed confidence in the economy and said he does not see inflation getting out of hand. But he also gave a slight acknowledgement to some of the turmoil in emerging markets, saying there are risk factors abroad and at home. But he didn't, you know, go into detail as far as what those risk factors are here at home. But he did say in time could demand a different policy response, meaning he would be accommodative to the needs of Wall Street. So that made the markets take off, dollar weakened, and of course gold and silver did rise. So yes, my prediction still seems to be a little more on tact because I think there will be one more rate hike in September. I don't think there will be another one. Because I do think that we're going to experience that turmoil, and he will accommodate the markets. But the Feds do meet. The next meeting is September 25th and 26th. And depending on a lot can happen between now and September 25th and 26th, and we'll have to wait and see. But I would expect a rate increase if the markets are still sort of where we are at today. There's some interesting news that hasn't been discussed today or talked about on, perhaps briefly on mainstream, but highly unlikely because they're all focused on the two that have gotten immunity, Weisselberg and Pecker. So everybody's been talking about that. But Trump did cancel Pompeo's trip to North Korea. He cites lack of sufficient progress on the denuclearization. He tweeted it out earlier today. He says that we're just not making sufficient progress. He says, additionally, because of our much tougher trading stance with China, he does not believe that they are helping. China is not helping with the process of denuclearization as they once were. Secretary Pompeo, he looks forward to going to North Korea in the near future, most likely after our trading relationship with China is resolved. In the meantime, he would like to send his warmest regards and respect to Chairman Kim, and he looks forward to seeing him soon. What's interesting, because it was just this week that Pompeo named Stephen Biegun, he's a former Bush administration official and a Ford Motor Company executive, as the U.S. State Department's special representative for North Korea. Pompeo said just yesterday, it's a very timely moment for Steve to join the team and come on board. He and I will be traveling to North Korea next week to make further diplomatic progress towards our objective. Well, it kind of makes me wonder if Pompeo didn't name Stephen Biegun without the approval of President Trump, and Trump just put the kibosh, you know, on the deal, in order to have Pompeo save a little bit of face, that they blamed it on the inability to make an agreement with this trade situation. So, I don't know. It's just an outside thought. You know, Mr. Trump, President Trump really likes Pompeo, so he's not going to embarrass him and say the things about Pompeo like he does with Sessions this week. The back and forth with the comments about what kind of man is Sessions, because he hasn't gone after the quote-unquote deep state and so forth. And I also heard that perhaps this is all planned discussion between the two, that they're really working on something, and maybe this is just a distraction, a little, you know, I don't know what to think of that. I'm not even going to go there. I mean, if this is their way of entertaining the citizens of this country, you know, I don't approve of that. So I would have to think that the back and forth is real. And but I doubt they're going to do anything before the midterm elections, or maybe they will. You just can't even. It's getting more difficult to connect those dots in today's world. You know, we talked about the trade war, and there was meetings this week. And it seems like the two governments, our government and China, have failed to make progress with the 2 days of talks. The two sides had met with low expectations for this week's meetings, and no further talks had been scheduled. The person who requested, I'm going to skip over this in this article. It seems quite likely that the U.S. will impose tariffs on the $200 billion in imports from China, which will trigger a bigger round of shooting. This is said from a former Commerce Ministry official and diplomat. And again, no one ever talks about who their sources are. No one wants to be named. And so we really don't know how much of it is fake news. But because they didn't come to an agreement, and the meetings ended with no agreements, we have to believe that a lot of this is fact. A former Commerce Ministry official and diplomat, Zhu Xiaoming, forgive me, sir, for the mispronouncing your name. Why can't they have names like Smith and Jones, I'll tell you. He says it is impossible for China to drop the Made in China 2025 and its industrial policies as a compromise. But there is haggling room in IP protection and market access issues, he said, referring to intellectual property protection. And the Trump administration is preparing a far larger tranche of tariffs covering some 6,000 products from China with an annual import value of $200 billion. That move and the anticipated retaliation from the Chinese would mark the largest escalation so far and start to hit American consumers more directly. The U.S. could impose the duties after a comment period ends September 6th, so I guess that's the next deadline. Additional purchases aimed at satisfying President Donald Trump's desire to reduce the trade deficit amount are one that China could deliver quickly. The second includes more substantive reforms that in many cases are already in train, such as opening up China further to U.S. credit card companies. China officially removed limits on foreign holdings in domestic banks and asset management companies it announced late Thursday, but the third basket of more difficult reforms, such as to industrial policy, are considered a no-go zone by the Chinese policy makers. So it's just interesting that they want to open up China to U.S. credit card companies, to banks, and it's just, you know, there's just no end. There's just no end. I mean, right now, at least China seems, at least now China's citizens believe in gold. They're encouraged to buy gold. You know, the citizens haven't gone too deep in debt. But hey, let's get those U.S. credit card companies in there and destroy their purchasing power and get them deep in debt like they have here for the citizens of this country. But we'll see. However, with this basket of more difficult reforms, the deal is almost impossible now, as Trump's domestic political scandals may cause him to be more aggressive on foreign policy. This is from a researcher at the Chinese Academy of International Trade and Economic Cooperation. So it continues, and we'll see how the trade reforms work out. There was a couple of interesting things that I thought were worth mentioning. It's a little terrifying, and this is not why I bring this, but it just does show us how dangerous of a world that we live in. The U.S. government is updating its nuclear disaster plans, and they are truly terrifying. Over the concerns of North Korea, the federal emergency managers are updating disaster plans to account for large nuclear detonations over the 60 largest U.S. cities. This is according to FEMA. Shift away from planning for small nuclear devices that could be deployed by terrorists toward thermonuclear blasts arranged by state actors was discussed yesterday at a two-day national workshop. Sciences workshop for public health and emergency. He says we're looking at 100 kiloton to 1,000 kiloton detonations. The agency's current nuclear detonation guidance for emergency planners, first released in 2010, had looked at 1 to 10 kiloton blasts. Now we're at 100 to 1,000 kiloton detonations. But after last year, after North Korea tested an apparent thermonuclear bomb with a surprisingly large estimated blast size of 250 kilotons, a city buster much bigger than past test blasts and nearly the size of current U.S. intercontinental ballistic missile warheads. And thus we have the negotiations of trying to get North Korea to denuclearize. But they went, and it's just kind of interesting, the timing of everything. But I think the most terrifying of this whole report was they opened up the meeting, the two questions, and they're also, the agency FEMA is also considering scenarios where a nuclear bomb, a cyber attack, a coordinated electromagnetic pulse, and biological weapons all hit the U.S. at the same time. So that was in response to an audience question, and they're actually considering something of this happening all at the same time. So I guess it is time that they update the duck and cover of the Cold War period, as so many of us had gone to through school and had our little lessons. So duck and cover over the weekend, ladies and gentlemen. Give Discount Gold and Silver a call at 1-800-375-4188. Myself and James Corbett will be returning right after this short break. And thank you for listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm pleased to welcome back to the program James Corbett. As you all know, James is the founder and editor of the Corbett Report, and he started that in 2007. And he does it all. He edits, writes, produces, and of course hosts the Corbett Report. In addition to that schedule, he became the editorial writer for the International Forecaster that was created by the economic analyst Bob Chapman. And make sure you visit James' website at thecorbettreport.com, thecorbettreport.com, and you can even request a complimentary issue of the International Forecaster by going to their website, theinternationalforecaster.com. James, how are you this evening?
I'm very good. Thank you for that introduction. But I should throw a little love to my video editor, Brock West. I used to do it all. Now he does my video editing. And without that, I don't think I'd be able to do it all anymore. It is a lot of work, as you can imagine. So it's a good thing I have a video editor these days.
All right. Yes. How many views? I mean, are your videos just on YouTube, or how many views have you received, or is it countable?
It isn't really countable. That's the thing. I mean, how do you count them? And how does, I mean, even a platform like YouTube, how do they count them? If you watch 1 minute of a 10-minute video, have you watched the video? Does that count as a watch? Do you have to watch all 10 minutes? I mean, they have their own ways of dealing with that question. I don't know. I think when people throw numbers around like that, you may as well be drawing it out of a hat. I can tell you it's in the tens of millions. There are tens of millions of views on YouTube alone, but I definitely do not just post to YouTube. I post to many different outlets, and consciously so, because I do not want YouTube to be that monopoly, because I am well aware that they could come along at any time and sweep my channel away from their platform. And if I wasn't posting to other platforms, all those videos would be lost to the ether. But I post to DTube, which is a blockchain-based alternative video platform, where it is saved on a blockchain through the IPFS, the Interplanetary File System. So once it's up there and encoded in the blockchain, there's no way to really get rid of it. I also post to BitChute, which works on WebTorrent technology, which essentially allows for peer-to-peer seeding of videos, so it's not a centralized platform like YouTube. And I also host videos directly on my own servers. So unless and until they take down the Corbett Report website itself, you will always have that repository there.
Well, that's incredible. That really is impressive. And I thank you for doing all that work, because it's so important in today's world.
Yeah. And people could I have just places throw in a plug? That's a good point to mention. Of course, you know, who knows what internet censorship switch can be flipped at any time. So it is a good idea to be backing this up. Of course, all of my material is absolutely freely available for download. But for ease of convenience and to support my work, you can buy my data DVDs, which basically each year I put out a data DVD that has all of the stuff, all of the podcasts, all the videos, everything that I did on that year in one DVD that you can purchase at CorbettReport.com/shop.
Oh, fantastic. Listeners, thecorbettreport.com. Anything? There's so much to talk about. And, of course, we're going to start out, eventually we're going to start discussing the Trump administration, the media. We all know yesterday's courtroom action where former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort, he was found guilty of 8 felonies. You have Trump's former quote-unquote fixer, Michael Cohen. He pleaded guilty to 8 felonies and essentially told the judge that his former boss directed him to violate campaign finance laws. I don't know if this is a great question to ask you, but your take on all this Washington dysfunction and how is it being addressed in the mainstream media in the United States, but also in your part of the world?
Yeah, well, I can tell you it is not a pressing issue over here, and it's not being covered breathlessly by the news, as I'm sure, and as I know it is in the United States, obviously, because clearly this is an internal domestic political matter in the United States more so than anything else. It could have profound ramifications, obviously, if we do see some sort of impeachment or whatever, but until that point, I don't think there's a lot of interest in the ins and outs of this investigation in Asia, and there's no interest whatsoever in this from myself, as an anarchist, a voluntarist, whatever you want to call it, as someone who does not participate in the political process of voting for a kinder, gentler slave master. I couldn't care less which person is in that seat of power or which person is grabbing the ring of power. And even so, I mean, does anyone really think, did they really believe that the president really controls the country and is the decider? No, clearly not. The real string pullers are the ones at the very first level of analysis, the ones who literally create the money might be the place to look. And in that regard, you'd be looking at the Federal Reserve. And in that respect, I mean, more interesting to me than the ins and outs of this investigation is the recent comments by Trump about Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell and his announcement about interest rates and continuing the hike. And Trump is mad about that. More interesting than that particular dynamic is the way that that's covered. I'm seeing that being covered in the U.S. media, where they're feigning shock and horror. Oh my God, a president trying to tell the Federal Reserve what to do. This is horrible. And I think that speaks to a much more important and interesting power relationship that exists within the U.S. government, of which the Federal Reserve is technically a part. It is a creature of government. It is based on a statute that was initially passed in 1913 and then on what was initially going to be a 20-year basis, but then it was extended and it's now indefinite. The Federal Reserve is just a part of government, but it's independent from government. And there's no president that can tell the Federal Reserve what to do, as Alan Greenspan said on PBS a number of years ago. And that's right. It is it's this weird independent creature of government that really does control the money supply. And that is an interesting dynamic. And so it's interesting to see, of course, the press freak out that a president would even question what the Federal Reserve is doing.
Well, it's interesting, though, because Trump chose Jerome Powell to take the position of the Federal Reserve Chairman after Janet Yellen. I mean, what did he expect?
Another thing to keep in mind with this is that the chairman is appointed by the president, but is always there's always a pre-selected list of the short list of candidates that is handed to the president, and you know, here's your options. So who are you going to go with? And there's no certainty in any of these types of appointments or picks. I mean, even with the Supreme Court pick, you could end up picking a justice that doesn't rule the way you thought they were going to rule, or things along those lines. And in this case, yeah, it doesn't mean that Powell is a minion of Trump and will do anything that he says. And in fact, the most recent quote that I saw from one of these stories about Trump is questioning the Federal Reserve was a quote about asking, well, what do you think of Powell so far? What do you think of your pick? And he said, I'll tell you in 7 years. So it really is, I think, a roll of the dice. Once you appoint someone in a position like that, what way they're going to act.
Well, you know, government always wants a weaker dollar. You have, you know, my buddy, and I say that to Larry Kudlow, always is King Dollar, interviewed shortly after he was elected his economic advisor to President Trump, buy King Dollar, sell gold. And so that is sort of, he's sort of in the mix too, of he wants a stronger dollar, Trump wants a weaker dollar. you have the Federal Reserve. So it's like, you know, they're all working against one another. Or is it just, again, just distractions and, you know, this is going to play out regardless of, you know, their statements, what they want and so forth?
I wouldn't call it a distraction. I mean, these are really fundamental issues, not just to the economy, but to society itself. Ultimately, the decisions that are made about monetary policy have that knock-on effect that really steer entire civilizations one way or another. And we can, I mean, there's a fascinating history to be written. I'm sure it's been written many times in many ways, but I think to concentrate specifically on history, the rise and fall of empires specifically related to their monetary policy would be a fascinating study, and one that I myself might undertake if I find a spare 20 years hiding under a couch somewhere. But that is one of the fundamental questions about society and where it's going, is the monetary policy and what way are you managing that and blah, blah, blah. And so I wouldn't call it distraction, but this is certainly a circumscribed discussion because, of course, it's all taking place within the framework of the system as it exists, the Federal Reserve System and the creation of most of the money supply, not 100%, but the vast majority of the money supply is created through debt that is ultimately owed back to the bankers, including money that the United States government is borrowing. And why do they have to borrow when they specifically in the Constitution, it says Congress creates the money, but they don't create the money. What's going on? So these are fundamental issues, but of course it's all taking place in that, within the very narrow lines that are prescribed for these types of debates. So again, it is important, and whether the Fed is tightening or loosening or what kind of policy they're enacting, whether they're doing QE or whatever, these things do have real effects on people's real day-to-day lives. It's just that those effects seem so distant from the actions that most people don't really understand and don't follow and don't care about these types of matters. They're much more interested in, you know, Stormy Daniels and whatever lawyer said what to who in the campaign in the last year.
Or they're also interested in just knowing that the U.S. bull paper market became the longest on record. And, you know, many of my clients are very puzzled. It seems like nothing disrupts, you know, the everyday workings of Wall Street, the paper markets, and everybody understands the amount of debt that this country is carrying. Everybody understands the European problems with Brexit, Italy. I guess Greece is coming along okay, at least temporarily. If they've been out of the news, they're supposedly able to handle their debt a little bit more. I mean, there's just everywhere you look, there's something that, I think we've talked about this before, but again, no reactions to any of these actions. And it's sometimes mind-boggling to think that something would just move a little bit.
Yeah, mind-boggling is a good word for it. Yeah, mind-boggling, because we are thinking rationally, and we're thinking, well, causes and effects are related, and here's an action, it should have this effect. But in the world that has been created, the magical wizardry world of Wall Street, that no longer applies, and it hasn't for some time. You could argue, I suppose, since the inception of the current monetary system, it hasn't, but especially in our day and age, where certainly since the 2008 crisis and the resulting actions of that from the Federal Reserve and its like-minded brethren central bankers around the world, it has skewed economic reality to the point where, as I've talked about before, there's an inversion that happened. We are now living in a magical time where still to this day, bad economic news is often considered by the markets to be good news because it just means there's more government intervention on the way. They won't let it collapse, so we know if there's bad news, they're just going to flood the markets with more magical QE money or something like that. And so we have this inversion going on. And yeah, as you say, the idea that we are in the highest recorded level markets in history, record markets, and the longest bull run in history, and all of this irrational exuberance, one might say, for for what? We are on the precipice of so many different cataclysms, geopolitically and economically, throughout the world, and we are now in such an interconnected global market that if something happens in China, it would have a knock-on effect everywhere in the world, including, of course, the United States, and vice versa, and many other countries besides could start a contagion that could spread around the world. It's a very perilous situation, and it doesn't necessarily mean doomsday or cataclysm is coming tomorrow, but the idea that the markets are almost euphoric and celebrating what's going on around the world, of course, makes no sense. And it can only be seen from the perspective of the elimination of that moral hazard that that in any moral, in any rational universe would keep people in check and in line. If you fail, you're going to fail. Well, the grand blinking neon light flashing sign that was posted in 2008 says, hey guys, if you fail, well, you might be too big to fail, so we'll come in and help you. And that has eliminated any rationality from the markets.
Yeah, it's like everybody is just going through all these emotions day in, day out, no passion, no emotion. It just drives me insane because it's just like you want to wake up the world. It's like everybody went to sleep, and it's just like we are on another plane. And you're right, you know, most of, you know, we think rationally. We try to, you know, connect the dots and see what's going on and so forth. We know that the world economies have been synchronized so that, you know, to the degree that they are, and that just can't stay together. It's beyond the realm of possibilities to keep this world synchronized, moving smoothly without something coming and certainly affecting many, many people.
Yeah, and, well, the synchronization is possible. This running smoothly is the other.
Well, yeah.
In fact, any destabilization or any great cataclysm that happened now would just be a further impetus for the people who were back in 2008 pushing for the New World Order, as they were calling it back in the 2009 G20 summit. They were calling for a New World Order, Gordon Brown and others, because, you know, here we are in this new economic reality. We need to do something. Well, those cries would be even more intense in this day and age. Oh, well, now clearly capitalism has failed, as they would say, and what we need is coordinated action by the central banks of the world acting in unison, and that will be the only thing to save us. So I have no doubt that whatever happens, the solution that's going to be proposed is more synchronization of the global economy under the rubric of the central bank system.
Well, you know, the Treasury yields curve continues to narrow and gets closer to inverting. These have been, and every inverted yield curve over the last 50 years has predicted a subsequent recession. Are we going to see that? Is that something to look for? Are there any signs?
That's the question. Are there any signs? Because I have seen at least 200 or 300 different signs, indicators, hey, every time this has happened in history, it's followed by a recession in the next quarter kind of thing in the last several years. I've seen dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of these. None of them have eventuated yet. And it is just a question of when. I mean, I have no doubt about it. This is not like this is some sort of, oh, now it's done and we're over and everything's recovered. No, there's clearly the piper will be paid. But when and how, there's no indicator like that. No chart, no graph, no statistic that I've seen that is convincing in and of itself to me. I think if you put it together, then you can really see the bigger picture that, yes, everything is blinking red, but it's always the question of what's the event that will kick it off, and I don't think anyone really has the answer to that.
As the show is being recorded on Wednesday night, Asian markets open cautiously. Investors are looking to the trade talks between Beijing and D.C., Washington, with the new U.S. tariffs on $16 billion of Chinese imports that are set to take effect later Thursday. China says that if they go through with it, the U.S. on the new tariffs, they're going to retaliate. Do you think? Well, I'm going to let you think about that until we come back for this next break, James. And ladies and gentlemen, we'll be right back right after these few short messages. And thank you for listening to Financial Survival.
Tell me again tonight. Each and every heart is prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and I'm here with James Corbett of the Corbett Report. Please visit his website, thecorbettreport.com. Sorry about that, James.
No problem.
But in your most recent article on thecorbettreport.com talks about the secret battle for Africa. You write that there's now a U.S. African command, that it was established in 2007. It has been the centerpiece of my country's attempts to gain a military foothold on the African continent. You continue that the extent of U.S. Special Forces penetration in Africa is a reality that is still only gradually being revealed to the public. Please tell us more.
Right, so I start that article noting that story from late last year where it turned out there were three Green Berets killed and two more injured in an action they were performing in Niger, to which everyone said, what? Why are the Green Berets doing stuff in Niger and what's going on there? And you know, U.S. African Command, what is that? Yes, there is a United States Africa Command. It was created and established in 2007, and I do have some reporting in my site up in the archives about that when it was first getting going. And essentially, surprise, surprise, the United States idea for getting involved, more involved in Africa and potentially exploiting, of course, the resources of Africa has always taken a military flavor, and more so in recent years with the establishment of U.S. AFRICOM. And so the special forces in Niger and other places, as it's gradually revealed here and there in a story of, oh, and some people were killed over here, we're starting to get the sense that there's a much greater penetration of special forces generally into Africa, because there is no African military base. The U.S., it doesn't have a base in Africa, so they have to do cooperation and joint ventures and these types of things with cooperative governments. So one way to get a handle on this is to look at the fact there are now 1,400 U.S. Special Forces that are deployed in Africa at the moment, which is about 16.5% of all the U.S. commandos, Green Berets, deployed overseas. To put that number in perspective, a decade ago, back in 2006, there was 1% of U.S. Special Forces deployed overseas were deployed in Africa, so about 70 Special Forces. Now there's 1,400. So there's been a vast buildup over the past decade, and of course that's been done under the cover of essentially North Africa and these different different Al-Qaeda or ISIS or terrorist boogeyman du jour groups in this or that country, and so we have to go in to get them kind of thing. But I think the bigger picture of what's developing here is, as I call it, a secret battle for Africa that's taking place between the United States and China right now. And the Chinese are not, I would say, primarily approaching it as a military struggle, although it is interesting to note, as I'm sure my listeners are aware, last year China did open its first ever overseas military base in Djibouti. Djibouti? Why Djibouti? Well, at Djibouti, if you go and look in the map, you will see it's an exceptionally geostrategically important location, being right there in a very key shipping route that will presumably, China wants to maintain access to the shipping routes to and from Africa, specifically from Africa, so they can get African oil and resources shipped up to China. And having a military base in Djibouti would be, I think, an important step towards that. So there is that aspect of it. But more importantly from the Chinese side is the economic side of it, the economic intervention into Africa, which is being done largely under the cover at this point of the Belt and Road Initiative, the $1 trillion global investment initiative that China's doing. But and that's taking the form of bilateral deals and cooperation agreements with Kenya and Senegal and Rwanda. And we've seen all sorts of infrastructure projects popping up in Ethiopia and Angola and Tanzania that are aided by China in various ways. They give low interest loans, they help with the construction itself, and everyone ends up happier and better off. The Africans get their infrastructure developed out, and the Chinese get the access to those resources and a happy trading partner. So everyone wins. As the Chinese like to say, it's a win-win situation. Except the cracks are starting to show in that, and the economic imperialism aspect of what China is engaging in is starting to come to the forefront. I did note in that article specifically about Madagascar and how Madagascar was happy when the Chinese investors started moving in, and oh, there's going to be development and infrastructure and what have you, and oh, by the way, we're going to buy up your farmland and your land at pennies on the dollar, and you're going to take it, because that's the way this rolls. And so people are starting to get a bit uneasy about this, not only in Africa, in Asia as well. The incoming Malaysian Prime Minister, Mahathir Mohamad, just canceled a couple of very big infrastructure projects that had been agreed with China in the previous administration. He canceled them saying, our local contractors could do this for half the price. Why are we paying Chinese contractors all this money to do it for us? And people are starting to question the loans and the way those loans are being operated. For example, in Sri Lanka, there was a deep water port that was constructed with Chinese aid and with Chinese construction that wasn't able to end up paying for itself. They couldn't pay the loan payments that were required to pay back China for the construction of the port. So now the Chinese state-owned company has taken over control of that port on a 99-year lease. So there are these hidden booby traps, of course, that always come with this type of economic aid that really represent the sort of neo-economic imperialism aspect of what China is doing. Having said that, generally speaking, I would say a lot of African countries are more comfortable and happy dealing at least with the economic imperialism of China, which does have its benefits, and we do see infrastructure and things being built, as opposed to the United States coming in with the barrel of the gun and pointing the gun at them. And in the article, I point specifically to a speech made by Muammar Gaddafi not too many years before his death, in which he talked specifically about that and said that China doesn't interfere in the internal affairs of other states, it doesn't bring in soldiers. More than 600 Chinese corporations are penetrating deep into Africa, and some Chinese communities have started to settle in Africa. This is China's soft approach. And then he goes on to say, because of that soft approach, Africans are welcoming China warmly. This will no doubt be to China's benefit. Afghans are wary of the U.S. Africans are wary of the U.S. because of its harsh approach. This is proof of the folly of American policy. And we all know what happened to Muammar Gaddafi just a couple of years after he uttered those words. So maybe proving the point that American military might and intervention seems to be America's answer to how to get a better foothold in Africa.
So what do you see happening on the African continent in this regard over the next decade?
over the next decade. It's very difficult to say because of so many different factors, but at least in the near term, I think that Africa is, again, by and large, happy to cozy up with China at this stage of the game. And one example of that that I point to in the article is the African Union headquarters. Yes, there is an African Union, and they did have a headquarters constructed in 2012, constructed mostly by Chinese companies, even using materials from China, as a kind of gift that China gave to the African Union. Here, have a headquarter. So that was constructed in 2012. Well, as Le Monde reported earlier this year, late last year, they discovered, hey, it seems our computers every evening are sending all of this data over to some servers in Beijing. What's going on? It seems that China had booby-trapped and basically bugged the African Union headquarters that they constructed and had been listening in on those conversations for the last several years. After that story was released, the African Union actually held a joint press conference with China to say, hey, no, that's all fake news. There was no bugging. It's all fine. Don't think about that. And, oh, by the way, this September, China is going to be throwing a big economic infrastructure investment summit with African Union leaders. So more tens of billions are going to be sloshed around. I'm of the cynical sort. I think there may have been a bit of, we'll invest much more money in you guys. You just, quiet this up. That's the way my mind works. But either way, it looks, at least in the short term, that there's going to be a lot more investment coming from China, unless and until there's some way to stop that. And the United States, I think, is probably thinking in a military sense.
Hmm. I can remember Obama had a very big summit with all the African leaders in D.C. During his term. I can't remember which term it was or what year it was, but I didn't understand at that point in time what the big deal was. It's probably so. So Africa is becoming a very important country.
Continent,
yes, thank you. So very interesting. I also read where Prime Minister Abe and President Trump agreed that they're going to work together toward the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. They apparently discussed the latest situation surrounding North Korea and are coordinating their policies in dealing with the country. The telephone conversation came ahead of Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's expected visit to Pyongyang, and it would be his fourth visit. Are you hearing anything about this in your neck of the woods, and would you like to comment?
Well, yes, of course. I mean, obviously, people are still very closely watching what's happening in Korea and with regards to the Korean Peninsula and any potential progress towards denuclearization. But I would take any kind of announcements or pronouncements of, we commit ourselves, we want a nuclear-free Korean Peninsula. That's just political blather, and it amounts to nothing in the real world unless and until they actually are able to accomplish it. How will they accomplish that? In what way? What specific form will that take? The devil is always in the details. So I'll believe it when I see it. It's nice to see them at least giving lip service to the fact that most people do want to see some sort of resolution to the Korean War, which is still technically ongoing, and the denuclearization of Korea, because that cannot be a good thing for humanity's sake. So one would hope there would be some resolution to this, but in terms of what's happening behind closed doors in negotiations, who knows, and in what way that could possibly develop. So again, it's one of those things I file under the believe it when I see it, but we might get more information when apparently Abe and Trump are going to be meeting in New York next month, so there may be something more substantive, at least in terms of actual agreements between the U.S. and Japan, but until then, who knows.
Is Abe getting any closer to resolving the issue of the Japanese nationals that were abducted by the North Korean agents in the 70s and 80s? Is that any closer to being settled?
No. I think really all that could have been expected and all that was really accomplished was, I believe, Trump raised the issue. I believe, I'm not sure on that, but I believe he raised the issue in his meeting with Kim or something along those lines. But in terms of the resolution of this issue, I just don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. Again, this is now a four-decade-old issue that it's a big political issue here in Japan, but I just don't think it's going to be resolved quite like that. Probably more importantly for Abe in the near term is his own question of his own control over his party. There is, I believe, an internal party vote that's coming up soon on the leadership of the LDP, the Liberal Democratic Party of Japan, the ruling party here, that essentially is a contest for the prime ministership, because obviously the leader of the party would likely take on that prime minister role, and there is a chance that Abe may be dethroned, which shouldn't be that surprising. He's been in power for, I don't know, 5-6 years now. It's been a very, in terms of Japanese prime ministers' lifetimes, that's like 100 years. So it's not surprising. There's been some scandals and things that are threatening to take him down. So who knows how long he'll continue to be in power, and whether he will continue to be in the position to meet with Trump or talk about Korea and the Korean future.
It looks like Japan and China, they're also in talks to resume a bilateral currency swap arrangement between their central banks. 3 trillion yen, which is, I think, about, what, $27 billion in, well, $27 billion in U.S. dollars. Looks like it might fall in relations between the world's second and third largest economies. We know that they have soured between one another in recent years due to the territorial disputes and tensions. Any comments on that?
I must admit, I hadn't seen this story yet, so I will reserve comment on it. But that is actually, I mean, in terms of the sort of economic monetary side of it, that's obviously fascinating. But just in terms of what that means for political relations, diplomatic relations, is also important, because as I understand, this was a currency swap agreement that had been in place, but that had been canceled. And so if they are going ahead with resuming this agreement, that could be potentially an important step towards some sort of fostering of warmer relations between Beijing and Tokyo generally. But again, I don't know the details of this story.
All right. We have about a minute and a half of the program left. Would you like to end the program with something that's perhaps we didn't cover this evening?
A deep and profound thought for the day.
Yes, thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, as always, there's so much going on that all I can do is pick and choose what topics I'm able to cover and in what way. But I am looking at the issue of Germany apparently coming along to propose an alternative payment settlement system, an alternative network to the SWIFT network, which your listeners might know about, which is essentially the global payment system that banks use to coordinate and settle international transactions, which is heavily politically influenced by the United States, although technically, theoretically, it's a neutral organization. But when the United States comes along and says things like, well, delist Iran, it will go and delist Iran so that suddenly Iranian banks can't contact the outside world.
Well, we'll have to talk about that on the next program. James, thank you so much for joining me today. And ladies and gentlemen, you too, thank you for listening to Financial Survival. We'll be back tomorrow. Until then, be safe, good night, and God bless.
Still, there never seems to be a single penny left for me. Fast and fast.